Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Welcome to it. How is everybody doing? How are you holding up? Look, I'm okay. You know, today is a kind of a heavy talk. I guess I got to do a little bit of not a trigger warning. I don't really like that term. But towards the end of this conversation with Regina King, you know Regina King, she's been acting since she was a teenager on 227 and broke through with her roles in movies like Boys in the Hood and Friday. She's an Oscar winner for her performance in If Beale Street Could Talk. She's won Emmys, Golden Globes, Independent Spirit Awards, a lot of stuff. Right now, she's in the new Darren Aronofsky movie, Caught Stealing, which I enjoyed. But towards the end, we do talk about the death of her son in some detail. He took his own life, and she's been public about it to a certain extent. It came up in terms of talking about grief and mental illness. So I'm just telling you now, it gets a little deep and emotional at the end. Okay, so if that's going to somehow, if you don't want to start crying on your run, you might want to pause it when we start getting into that. But it's an important conversation. The whole thing was great. She's great. She's great in this new movie. I went to see a screening of Caught Stealing, and it's interesting because they really. You know, Aronofsky really kind of gets the grit and, kind of filth of New York at that time in the early 90s. It was shot literally a block from my old house. A lot of it takes place on Avenue A between 4th and 7th on Avenue A. He rebuilt the facade to Benny's Burritos. Kim's Video was there. So it was all very familiar to me. Because I was around then, or even shortly before that, I was still living down there. So it does have that vibe. But there's something I learned about watching this movie is that a lot of surprises in the movie, actually. And it's a pretty good story. And everyone's good. Regina's great. Austin Butler's great. Zoe Kravitz. Everyone's good. But there's something about violence that when it's not gratuitous, when it's not heightened or detached from, character in a way, or if people get some violence done at them, to them, and they don't really have it coming, it's gnarly. There is an element of comedy to this thing, but the characters are deep, and Austin's character is a flawed and troubled guy, but it is, definitely worth seeing. I mean, I think any Aronofsky movie is worth seeing. But it was kind of great to talk to Regina today because it's a good talk. So my show at Largo tonight is sold out, but I'll be back there with the band on Wednesday, September 10th. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. Also, next week, we're doing an Ask Mark Anything bonus episode. So this is the last call for you to send in your questions. Just go to the link in the episode description of today's show and send me whatever you want to ask. Then get the bonus episode in your full Marin feed next Tuesday. How's that sound to you? I talked to a class down at the Annenberg School for communications and media or whatever. A woman asked me to come speak to her class. I didn't realize it was the first day of that class. I didn't realize that I didn't really know what the class was about. And she just asked me questions, and there maybe there was 20 people in the room. And there was part of me that one time thought, like, oh, I could be a teacher. I don't think I can. I don't think I know how to be in front of an audience for very long without, you know, getting a laugh or knowing that I'm connecting. And I tell you, teachers have got a tough job. You've really got to, you know, somehow kind of put some sort of filter on to not, you know, wonder whether you're connecting or not. And also, I think I forget what it was like to be in college and who I was in college and what I knew versus what I thought I knew. Big gap. And if I really think back on it, like in philosophy class or logic class or even some of the classes about romantic poetry and stuff, it was way above my mental pay grade there. I tried to take it all in, but I did not come together for me. I feel like it's just starting to come together now. I mean, I wasn't even talking in any lofty way, but I think there's just some basic things about talking about what you're thinking with points of reference and whatnot that could get totally lost. And I'm not saying they weren't paying attention. Some of them had good questions about show business and whatnot. But I just had that moment where I was walking on campus and I was like, I kind of remember this. I kind of remember who I was when I was like 21 or 20 at Boston University, you know, wondering if my trench coat was cool or whether my glasses frames are okay. How was my haircut? You know, just kind of going to these classes and, you know, playing the role of student, playing the role of a smart guy or a guy who thought he was smart. But in terms of what I really could grasp in college, in terms of, you know, the classes I was taking, you know, film studies and some satire classes, it's just the language of academics, the language of philosophy, the language of criticism. It was just, my brain was too blown open. I couldn't contextualize or compartmentalize much of anything. And I still strove to do it, and I have my whole life. And I think I've gotten a little better at it, but sometimes when I try to, you know, read the texts of criticism or philosophy, I don't fucking know. I just dump stuff into my head. Sometimes I pull something out that kind of aligns with kind of what I'm thinking. Then I feel validated and I'm like, yeah, me and this guy who's a brilliant cultural critic, we're kind of thinking the same thing. I just had half a joke about it, but there's half a book about it here. But I think I nailed it. I think I had it. Maybe that's all I need. Maybe I can let that go. But I do know that I don't think I could be a teacher. But these conversations, they're still the lifeblood of what I do and you know, who I am. And this one, as I said earlier, it does get heavy. And yeah, something kind of interesting happened during it. You know, I was able to kind of hold the space and listen and remain empathetic. But I didn't really kind of get, you know, I didn't really attach to my own grief till kind of later in the conversation about hers. And I think that was good. I think that's okay. You know, it was Lynn Shelton's birthday yesterday. I believe she would have been 60. And a couple of people were like, I hope you're okay today. I'm like, I think about it a little bit every day. I think the anniversary of her passing is more difficult. And I don't know if I've compartmentalized it, but there's some part of me that just knows that and has known for a while that, you know, in light of the tragedy of her death, but it's just people die. And I don't think I've become callous to it, but there's a bit of an acceptance to it, to the struggle of living and the reality of dying and, you know, what you do in between and, you know, how do you kind of navigate the urgency to to get those tweaks done. So you go out fully formed and okay. Be nice to go out okay, as opposed to go out, hey, wait, I got it. I'm okay. Cut. No, wait, give me one more. Cut. Fuck. I think I've decided on my epitaph. You know, these things come and go. Some of them are funny. Some of them are honest. But I think on my tombstone, if I do that, or on my urn, on my plaque, I think I just wanted to say the other shoe. Huh? What do you make of that? Pretty good? The other shoe. I like it. Anyway, Regina King is here. And as I said earlier, it does get heavy. It might be emotional for some of you towards the last 15 minutes or so of this talk. She's in the new Darren Aronofsky movie, Caught Stealing, which opens tomorrow in theater. She also has a new wine line called Me and You, spelled M-I-A-N-U. And that's important because it is a passion project that we discuss. It actually kind of moved us through a discussion of grief that I didn't know really how we were going to kind of move out of. It's interesting when you talk to people and that stuff comes up, and I started feeling mine and she was feeling hers, and you're like, I don't think we're going to be able to get out of this because we need to let it happen. And but it kind of went right into this reason that she created this wine, and it's touching. So this is me talking to Regina King.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, painful authenticity. That's what it's all about.
That's what we're opening up with, right?
Well, you know, I don't think I know how to do it any other way.
Yeah.
I guess it takes a while to get to your authentic being.
You know what? I think that's true. And I think some people never quite find that.
Yeah, because you put up like all these defenses or ways of getting through life, and then you kind of get used to those. And if you never have that moment where you're like, well, this is bullshit, and find the courage to kind of get past it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the hard part, right?
Harnessing the courage.
Yeah.
Yes. That is the hard
because
part.
Because people are shitty.
Yeah.
They're always thinking about themselves. And I don't know, I deal with it a lot now, and I'm 61. I think about it more now, like when I perform.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting because you hear so many people as, you know, I would say, even thinking about myself, each decade,
yeah,
I feel like I discover a new version of myself.
Yeah.
Or I have a new, I don't really give a fuck,
yeah,
you know, moment,
well,
you know?
That helps the new version of yourself.
Exactly.
As you get older and the zero fucks kind of start to stack up, you realize, like, I really don't give a shit. And that's a powerful place to come from.
Yeah.
When you really don't give a shit,
because
if you really don't, it's freedom.
It's freedom.
Yeah.
It's freedom.
And I don't know, like on stage lately, I've just been... I wrote down in my notebook yesterday, I wrote, limit swagger.
I just, like that.
Just to see what'll that do?
LS.
LS. And you know, just get down to the voice of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Because like we live in this world now where nobody shuts up. And
oh my
it's
gosh.
Just
yes.
Dude,
the noise.
It's fucking crazy.
The noise.
It's just like a never ending yammering. Just people gah, 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 and there's a frequency to it. It's
yeah.
almost like a mania. And I don't it just gets to the point where you got to save your brain.
1,000%. It's so crazy that you said that.
Why?
Because just yesterday, you know how like your car hooks up to your Bluetooth, and
yeah.
if you don't turn it off, just as soon as you get in the car, it automatically starts playing,
right.
you know, what's
yeah.
on your Spotify or whatever.
Right.
And so this one podcast
yeah.
that I was listening to
yeah.
because there was... And I've never heard of the podcast before.
Yeah.
And it popped up on my like yeah. Flipboard.
Right.
And so I was curious about that topic.
Yeah.
So I'm going to listen to
yeah.
it. And it was interesting, you know.
Yeah.
It was only like 24 minutes.
Yeah.
Good for me.
Sure.
And for whatever reason, I get in my car. And I was actually listening to it while I was in New York. So I'm back in L.A.
Yeah.
in my car. And it had gone to the next episode, and the voices.
Yeah,
it was really making me feel crazy.
Yeah, yeah. It's because everyone is like I did radio years ago.
Yeah,
like morning radio. And I just realized this recently that in order to get up and do live radio and get, you know, people are going to work. You get into this tone. What's everybody got going? And here we go. This is where we're talking at this level. And you lock into that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, I think it happens innately when people get on these mics.
Right.
And they feel like there can't be any pauses. You know, to learn how to pause like this. Well, you got to, you know, you have quieter podcasts
mm-hmm.
in there. But the general means of talking on these mics is gah, 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 gah. And
right.
then on TV, it's all that. No one stops.
It's no one stops. And it's like on a frequency that is annoying. And
yeah.
I have to be honest that
yeah.
I kind of discovered that with myself with talking on the telephone, that
yeah.
I would go into a pitch
yeah,
that
yeah,
was
yeah.
really, I started hearing myself.
Right. For an interview or just in general?
Just in general.
Yeah.
You know what
well,
I mean?
It's good you still pick up your phone.
Yeah. I still use it for a phone.
That's good.
But yeah, like
yeah.
That same like
yeah.
moment that you had when you left radio,
yeah,
morning
right.
radio,
yeah.
I had that same realization like maybe about 10 years ago or so
yeah.
where I was like, you know what? This conversation is not the problem. I am the problem because my tone is up so high.
Yeah. And even as a like an actor, I mean, you know the power of pauses.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in regular conversation, sometimes you just sort of like, Let's get this done.
Yes. But you know, that's a funny thing. Another funny thing I realized.
Yeah.
That's how you know with some of those commercials that they're AI. Because there are no pauses. They're,
right.
They just go.
Yeah.
Go,
yeah.
Go.
I can't even wrap my brain around the AI
I
yet.
Know.
I don't know what to do with it.
It's insane. It's here.
Well, I know it's yeah. here, but like everyone's talking about it. And like maybe I'm not knowing when I'm engaging it. Like I'm not a complete sucker. I do like the AI when you search for something on the Google and
yeah.
you get all these different options. That seems helpful.
Yeah.
And when I see some of the AI on the reels on the IG, some of them are funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know, you know, what's slipping by me.
Right.
And what's real and what isn't real.
What isn't, mm-hmm.
I feel like there has to come a time where we can make a choice to detach from all of it for periods of time.
Well, I think for any sanity.
Yeah.
You do have to consciously make that decision to detach.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's like drugs, man.
Yeah.
I mean, even like when you're on set, you know, and like cut and everyone's just in their chair.
Yeah, I've been doing the last two projects that I've been on. I've been leaving my phone
yeah.
in the trailer.
How's that working out?
It's worked out really great. But also because.
What did you do with that time?
I actually
look
at the script.
Yeah.
But usually I don't bring my script to set, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
When I started a show called Southland,
yeah.
Christopher Chulock, who was the producing director there, he made a mandate that no sides were allowed on set.
No sides.
And that was probably the best gift he could have ever given. I feel like all of us that were on that show probably still operate in the same way. So since then, you know, I don't bring, unless I have a question specifically for the director and I want to remember my notes that I had written in my script, that's the only time I'll bring my script to set.
Really?
But it just, it's almost like the script sometimes can be like, is Linus the one on Peanuts with the blanket?
Yeah.
It's like your binky.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so even though you might have prepared, sometimes you just will go up on a line just because you don't have that piece of something right there with you. And I feel like it was really liberating that he had done that. And if I do go up on the line and I'm not able to substitute it with something else because I am actually in the scene, I just will old school call out line.
Sure. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, so it helped your whole process.
Helped my whole process.
How many episodes did you do of that, Southwind?
We did 4 or 5 seasons. So, I want to say we did like 50 episodes.
So that's like a full training in No Sides.
Oh, 1,000%. And whenever we would have guest actors that would come on, they would freak out. And I mean, and these are like established actors.
Just for the day?
Just for the episode.
They think they're going to knock it out and just have the sides and learn them that day?
And then they get that mandate and they're like, oh my God, you guys really, they really enforce this? And we're like, yeah.
Yeah, because you're on set and people are like, wait, cut, can you take the sides out of your pocket? We're seeing the sides.
We're seeing the sides, all of that, you know, or Chris also felt like, with the sides, people were disrespecting the words. You know, you see them on the ground, people walking on them, using them as coasters.
Sure.
You know,
just garbage.
Yeah, just garbage.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, I thought it was great, and I still use that to this.
So, that, but it also forces you to prepare in a different way, like the real way, like really know it.
To really know it, and honestly, it also forced a lot of actors. Forced us to have conversations and ask questions before we're actually shooting the scene.
Oh, good.
Because that's eating up time in the day.
Yeah.
So we would have like incredibly short days because all of the work was already done.
And that's sort of the job. Well, it becomes difficult when you do like a whole movie. Like I watched Shirley and I mean, so you didn't have your sides at all?
No, I didn't. What I had was the script supervisor and my dialect coach. And my dialect coach would, before every scene, we would just go over. Because sometimes there were like 3 or 4 really big speeches in Shirley.
Yeah.
And, you know, they needed to become part of me. And so those speeches, I feel like, I didn't need to go over those lines as much because I'd already, you know, like, got to get these speeches.
Right.
And it was more just the dialect coach just pointing out places that I may have, you know, dipped with the dialect. But it was for the scenes that are with other actors where I really relied on my dialect coach and script supervisor and luckily had really... I had actors that are in this for the art form.
Yeah.
So we wanted to go through lines.
Yeah,
we wanted to. So we did a lot of just running our lines just together.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a good. It was a good cast.
Yeah.
And
oh, so awesome.
What is that? What is her dialect exactly? Slightly.
Shirley has such a unique dialect. So she's Bayesian, but she's born in New York.
Yeah.
Then lived in Barbados for... Like,
and her husband's from there?
No.
Jamaican?
Her husband's Jamaican.
Yeah.
Yeah. And her, I call him her consigliere.
Yeah.
Oh, rest in peace, Lance.
Great actor.
Awesome actor.
Yeah.
He was Ghanaian.
Yeah.
So,
it's interesting.
So sometimes the three of us, we, and the Michael Cherry, who played Shirley's husband.
Yeah.
He is actually Trinidadian.
Wow.
So we were all working with dialects, and sometimes when all three of us were in a scene together, we really had to work to not start picking up the other dialect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to do that here.
Yeah.
Like, it happens sometimes. I'll become, sometimes if I interview an old Jewish comedian, I'll ask my producer, at what point did I turn into an old Jew? When did that happen?
So you're an actor.
Well, I act, yeah.
Yeah, you're an actor.
I do the thing. I mean,
because that's what we do. We can't really help but... We're like sponges.
It? Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know if I ever framed it as an actor. I just thought I was needy and believed that other people's lives were infinitely more interesting than mine. But, so I just kind of glom on, you know, take the ride.
Are you a people watcher?
Sure.
So yeah, because every actor that I know, we're all people watchers.
I do it a lot more. I'm doing it more again.
Yeah.
Because you know who Robert Crumb is, the cartoonist?
No.
Well,
that name sounds familiar. Yeah,
an underground cartoonist. Okay. He did, like, in the 60s, he did, like, Mr. Natural and all that. You'd probably recognize
the cartoon. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he has a very specific way of looking at almost everybody, and it's kind of, like, almost just slightly grotesque.
Mm.
and I just watched a doc about him again, and I've been looking at everybody kind of like that. And it humanizes
slightly
them.
Grotesque.
Yeah, slightly.
Just even the playing field.
Slightly grotesque. Hold on one second. I don't want to be rude, but I just want to say hi to my mother.
Oh, hi, Mom.
Yeah, hold on. It's hard to get her. Hello?
Hi.
Well, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I'm interviewing somebody, but I didn't want to miss your call. Are you doing okay?
Yeah.
Yeah? Were you watching me in that show?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
I loved it.
Oh, good. Look, I'm trying to make plans to get down there. So try to stay here.
Don't okay.
go. All right. But you feel good?
Yeah.
All right. I love you. I'll talk to you. I'll call you tomorrow.
Okay, babe. Bye-bye.
Oh, moms are the best.
Well, so.
And you're such a, yes, you are truly a comedian. The fact that you would say, so just stay here.
Well, she's down in Florida, and I haven't been able to get down there. And, you know, she is getting older. So there's that thing where whatever my relationship with her is, you kind of go through life, and you're kind of like, yeah, I'll call her later, and I'll whatever. And then all of a sudden, you're like, I got to.
Yeah. My sister and I, we're going to have a real deep conversation right now. We go. Once she'll go for 1 week and I'll go for 1 week. Our mother's in Ohio, and because my stepdad died a couple years ago, and so she's in this house by herself.
Oh,
and
she's still in her house.
Still in a house. She doesn't want to move. She doesn't want to move here.
Are there stairs?
Yes, the stairs are what's keeping her heart going.
Oh, good.
You know, she goes up those stairs faster than but. You know, she's 81, and so we're gonna have to. It's thank God I have an amazing my bonus sister. She's our stepsister, but so even though her father passed, you know, she still comes and sees my mom every other day.
Oh, that's
so
the best.
Yeah, she is absolutely the best. I love you, Stephanie.
Oh, that's the best.
And but you know, we're gonna have to
do it.
Yeah, we're gonna have to come more than. You know, 1 week out of the month.
And she's still chatty and with it?
She's battling the beginning stages of dementia.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm finding a lot of my friends were in the same place with their parents. But the thing that's really kind of heartbreaking, watching your parents lose their independence, is that with my mother's situation, she's aware of it.
Yeah.
It's not like she's not aware
of the mental thing.
She's a teacher.
Yeah.
And so she feels the decline, and we'll be in mid conversation and she'll just stop.
Yeah.
And she'll say, I just don't know the words.
Yeah.
I want, you know, and so to know that that's happening to you, you know,
it's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. So we just try to remind her just to give herself grace, you know.
Well, that's nice, because my dad's pretty far gone with it, and he doesn't seem to know at all.
Well, that's, you know, what we commonly recognize, you know, any type of dementia. Or, I hate the word dementia. I want to just call it old timers.
Yeah. I say my dad's newly demented. Because, you know, dementia is sad, but newly demented, it's like, what's going to happen?
What's this thing? Yeah.
Well, there is something to that. I mean, he still seems to know me, and, you know, his wife is a bit younger than him, and she kind of makes him listen to the podcast and stuff. So he knows me. And, but, like, day of stuff, you can dig up some memories and stuff. But, like, you ask him if he feels well or if he remembers the movie, he doesn't seem to care.
Mm.
Like, I think he's in the ventriloquist dummy stage of dementia where his wife, I'll say, did you see a movie yesterday? And he goes, yeah, Rosie, what was that movie? So she just speaks through it.
And
it keeps his brain alive.
Yeah.
But the whole, I don't know, both of them are still alive. You know,
yeah.
Did your parents have you young?
Well, my mother, I don't know. I mean, I feel like she was born in the 40s, so she had me at 26, 27. Oh. So that's the age that most people, now people are having children later in life.
Oh, yeah.
So I would say, no, my mother was a normal age and my father was older.
Uh-huh.
My father was 16 years older than my mom.
Wow, yeah.
He was, yeah.
My mom was 22, but even 26, if you think about a 26-year-old now, you're like, what?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I have my son at 25.
Really?
So, yeah.
You're like a kid.
Well, I didn't feel, I mean, you know, I owned a home at that time.
Sure.
Yeah. So I've been working since I was a child.
Well, I guess you're not really a kid, but like,
well, in some cases, yeah. I will definitely say that lucky to have the mom that I have.
Yeah.
Because I do know even then that I was much more mature than my peers.
Yeah. And does she, you don't come from Ohio, do you?
No, I'm born and bred in L.A. My parents met here in L.A.
Okay.
And had me and my sister.
And what's she doing in Ohio?
She went back to, my mother's from Ohio.
Oh.
So about little over 30 years ago, when my grandmother was starting to slow down a bit, she moved.
Yeah.
Back to Ohio to be closer to her.
Oh, her mom.
Yes.
But you're not planning to move back to Ohio.
That's the, we are going to have that conversation.
Really?
Well, I mean, I'm not at a place where I'm okay with moving my mother out of a space where she is uncomfortable.
Right.
Where she's comfortable.
Yeah.
To a space that she has to get to know.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, she remembers things.
Yeah.
It's not like, where am I? She doesn't have, you know, any of that. She's very much aware. She keeps her calendar. She, you know, and she just knows where everything is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's our mom. Yeah. So we right now, we're going to be the ones to have to
change. What would you think about, like, just getting an apartment there or something? Or
Well, the house that she's in is big you know.
Right.
And it's just her in it. So I think, look, I'm having this conversation with you and I haven't started having it with my sister yet. So the plan to have the conversation with my sister.
You can just
is
tell
that
her to
maybe,
listen to this.
Yeah, listen to the podcast and what the That might be her response
when I tell her.
But my thought is that maybe we would just, how we're alternating weeks now, that maybe we just kind of stretch it out and alternate months.
Yeah.
You know?
That might work out.
Yeah, it might. We'll see.
So getting back to Shirley, that movie seemed like it was a movie that I didn't think I'd ever see.
Mm.
And, you know, my memories of Shirley Chisholm were, you know, I was a kid.
Yeah.
But I remember it was a big deal. So really watching your movie was the first full arc of education I got about her.
Wow.
And it's an important story.
Yes.
So when did you get hung up on that story?
My sister and I got hung up on that story about 17 years ago. I mean, because separately, we both had conversations with people who had never even heard her name.
Right.
And so that was a little mind-blowing for us. And then we did a little bit more asking people about, do you know who Shirley Chisholm is? And found that more of our East Coast friends knew who she was than West Coast friends.
Yeah.
And we were like, okay, her story, she's like the godmother of first, you know?
Yeah.
And she's the blueprint.
Right.
And so we set out to do this film, and it took us this long to get to actually it becoming a reality.
How did you, like, how did the process happen? Because it was your idea? You like, optioned a book, or you bought the story? Or
actually, so we were with a lot of different teams of writers along the way. Well, not a lot.
Yeah, went through a lot of versions?
Yeah. Only one version of a script.
Right.
But two other ideas of what it could look like. And so the first writing team we were with, they we're still close to them now. We still are trying to find that project to do. But what happened is their stars started rising, my stars started rising, and we just, the time.
Yeah.
We'd put together a package. We had, you know, locked in on an outline that we felt like was good.
Yeah.
And then we just started, you know, life started and going different ways. And then Raina and I picked it back up again. It may have been...
she your production partner?
My production partner. Uh-huh. My sister Raina is my production partner. And I can't really remember exactly when, but it was... I was shooting the third season of American Crime with John Ridley.
John Ridley.
And I said, Raina, what do you think about John Ridley?
Yeah.
You know,
why not?
Why not? You know, he loves history, you know? And she was like, ask him why you're on set. And I'm like, okay. So
you got the time. You're not using your phone.
Yeah, I'm not. I see what you did there. That's a true comedian. You guys know how to bring nets back. I love it. So asked him. He loved the idea. And so we started getting to work. And in that small amount of time, all of a sudden an announcement was made that Viola Davis was going to be doing Shirley Chisholm.
Yeah.
And
another project.
Another Shirley Chisholm project.
How the fuck does that always happen?
I don't know. And here's the thing. We had the rights from her sister, the life rights from her sister.
Yeah.
So we had been, even though that long pause had happened before we approached John, we still kept continuing the rights with their sister, Muriel.
Right.
And Muriel was like, you know, am I going to see it one day? And we were like, Muriel, we are.
Yeah.
And she died just as we were starting production. So that was kind of pre-production.
Yeah.
So that was sad. But, you know, we kept our word, you know. And
did Viola make hers?
No. So what happened was when I saw that announcement, we got together, kind of huddled as a team, and had talked about, well, we should make an announcement too. And I said, you know what? I love Viola. She's like amazing.
Yeah.
And I think she would be an amazing Shirley Chisholm. So if she's made it there first, then you know what?
Wow.
We'll have to step away.
Yeah.
And whatever happened, that didn't work out.
Yeah.
And as soon as it didn't work out, we jumped back in, made an announcement.
Did you talk to her about it?
I still have not talked to her about it.
I know John Ridley. We started doing comedy together.
Yes.
That's crazy.
I keep forgetting that's where John, you know,
writing. For a few years there.
Yeah.
And he was good. He was like angry and intense.
Angry and that dry.
Yeah. And I talked to him. He was on the show years ago. But he's really kind of become a lot of things. Better that he stayed out of comedy.
1,000% better that he stayed out of comedy. I feel like when he first said that he in the comedy space with writing as well, and I was like, I just feel like I'd have to think too much about the joke to get the joke.
he's a very smart guy, and he had some very smart jokes. I still remember a couple of his jokes. I brought it up about it. But so do you find that, how did people react to the story? Did you get feedback on Shirley?
I mean, you know, you never know if people are giving you a BS version of what they feel about something, but it felt genuine.
Yeah.
Every person that expressed that they did not know. Thank you for letting them know. They didn't.
Sure.
We got a lot of that.
Yeah.
We got a lot of, you know, this that they thought it was just such an amazing cast.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we got a lot of people who were, you know, like part of the campaign.
Yeah. Oh, really?
They were teenagers.
Yeah.
And who were very thankful for telling Mrs. C's story.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great. And the, but you didn't want to direct that one?
No. That the acting and the embodying her, that's heavy lifting.
Yeah.
You know,
I
did not
especially
want
with the
to
dialect and everything, and
just all of it. She's such a specific character. You know, just from how she walked. The way she spoke, the way she would change the way she'd speak depending on who she was talking to.
And you got to study footage too, I imagine.
Yeah.
And it's hard, like if you're in every scene, how are you going to really direct? It's all on.
I mean, and people do it, and I've seen like a great, like Don Cheadle did an amazing job.
Miles Davis?
Ahead.
Oh my God. That people don't talk about that movie enough.
Yeah.
What a weird fucking movie that is.
What a weird fucking great movie. You
totally
know what I mean? Like that.
Totally.
This, you know, it's stylized.
Because it's like a whole thing's like a hallucination.
Yeah.
And
which
I thought it
makes
was,
sense to
totally
the eyes of mine.
Yeah. I thought it was great.
I thought it was amazing. It's
such a shame, like in this world of media, that things just come and go.
I know.
And it becomes hard to find.
I know.
And people work so hard on them.
I feel like part of it is because there's just so much content.
I know.
Now.
Yeah. Just the idea that we call it content now is terrible.
I know. And how so much content is being made to entertain distracted people.
Yeah.
People who can't actually put their phone down and watch a film.
Yeah.
Or watch
a show. Well, they keep telling us that people aren't capable of attention span, but they're guilty of causing that.
1,000%.
People are capable.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've designed the system based on an algorithm that, you know.
Don't get me started.
All right.
Yes, don't get me started.
But what made you decide that for your film directing debut, That night in Miami was the one to do?
Well, I had a meeting with my lit agent.
Yeah.
And he was a new lit agent.
Yeah.
I didn't gel quite right with the first one that I had.
Sure.
And so with Harley, we went to lunch and I told him that I wanted to do something that was entertaining, but that was centered, that the story had a true real life happening as the backdrop.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, he asked me the question, what type of films do I want to direct? And I'm like, all types of films, but this is one.
Yeah.
And he sent me three scripts that met that note.
Yeah.
And when I read One Night in Miami, I was like, oh my God, like this is my father, this is my son, this is my uncle. Like I could see all the men that really have made an impact in my life. It felt like if them and their friends were having real heart-to-heart discussions, debates, that they would look something like this,
right? And but people with consequence,
With consequence,
cultural, political,
yes.
And I mean, like, and that's a real story.
Yeah,
it's crazy because not unlike Shirley, which was a different and bigger story. This was sort of a clandestine. You know, no one would know this story necessarily.
Yeah,
but somebody, it was a play first.
It was a play. Kemp Powers had written the play, and it had done really well. And, I mean, it performed all the way from the West End to here.
So is it based on a real event, or is it?
Yes, that night actually took place.
With It was Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, Malcolm X.
Yes, that night actually took place after Muhammad Ali's win.
Yeah.
That literally solidified him into being the great that we know him to be. And again, like those conversations that they were having are conversations that a lot of black men were having. And so what is it for me, like what, how powerful for Kemp to be fearless enough to write a story to put these four giants and say, we're going to look at them as just regular men.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that was the trick. Yeah. And they're all very different.
Could not be more different. And that's really like if, you know, people always say, well, what is this story saying? What message? Is that, I think for me, is that there's no only one right way to do something.
Yeah.
You know, it's situational. Yeah. You know, this move may be the best move. Yeah. This move may be the best move. And sometimes it's a combination of all of them together and seeing, especially that relationship between Sam Cooke and Malcolm X, I was especially beautiful to me to be able to consider that there is a such thing, and human beings actually do debate healthily.
Yeah.
And actually grow.
Yeah.
From those.
Yeah, challenge each other.
Yeah, challenge each other.
Take the hit and change their thoughts and change their minds.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a beautiful thing, that movie.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Do you think, like, do you consider your first big break with Singleton?
You know, honestly, Mark, I feel like I have a few big breaks. I feel like, obviously, you know, when I was on the show, 227, that's just as a child.
Yeah.
You know, that's huge.
Yeah.
And then I feel like then the next one was with John and Boys in the Hood, busting out of being the little girl on
a little girl show.
227, know, that did no wrong.
Yeah.
And then Jerry Maguire.
So
I felt like those three were just really pivotal moments in my career that the industry started to see me as truly an actor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, but like when you direct, I mean, did you, like, I assume Singleton was kind of a force as a director.
Absolutely.
And because
it was fun.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, you're younger and it was exciting.
Yeah, it was exciting.
Fun cast.
Yeah.
But like, I think, and I've said this before, but I think Baby Boy is a fucking masterpiece.
Yeah.
I mean, like that movie, I can't believe that movie.
Yeah. One of John's abilities is to recognize talent in people that we don't even know that we have.
Yeah.
And identify that. And so that was the case with, you know, while Tyrese may not have been trained and Taraji was more trained, I think he recognized something in both of them let's put these two together.
It was so,
you know,
it's hilarious.
Yeah. It's hilarious and it's heartbreaking and it's, you know, it's all the things.
Yeah. Ving Rhames.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Project that we're developing now.
Yeah.
At our company, a character in there. The plan is when we get the official green light.
Yeah.
That I'm calling Ving up.
You like, are?
Hey, it's time for you to reprise that energy that you had there. Yeah.
It was something else, we'll right?
If he hears this, it's an early call out.
Yeah. Where did you start acting? Did you train here?
Yes, here in LA.
In school, or did you just seek it out? Because it's interesting when people grow up in LA because it's all here.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, my mother, being a teacher, also was always and still does believe that arts are just as important to exercise your brain and all of that as math, science, and
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and so she always supported anything my sister and I wanted to do. Yeah. So whether it was tap dancing or playing piano, we just had to stick through it throughout the amount of time we signed up for.
Sure.
And so we were at one of my mom's friend's house, and up the street from that friend, Todd Bridges lived.
Yeah.
And his mom, Betty Bridges, was outside roller skating while we were outside roller skating. So, you know, at 8 years old, it's kind of like, to her, I would never think that now, but she was an old lady to us. And we were like, oh my gosh, she's out here on roller skates.
Yeah.
And I guess us being so curious about it and asking her, you know, so it doesn't hurt for you to skate, you know, just asking her all of the dumb kid questions.
Yeah.
And actually, there's no dumb question, only the one that wasn't asked.
Yeah.
I don't fully believe that. I was just
But for the kids that are listening.
For the kids that are listening.
Yeah, be questions. Yeah, ask questions.
Yeah, ask questions.
Yeah.
And so she, I guess, took a liking to us being so, you know, bold to ask a grown-up these questions. So she was like, well, where do you guys stay? And we're like, we're just visiting our friend. And she was like, well, is your mother here? And we were like, yeah. And so she roller skates to that. Yeah, we didn't really know.
Yeah,
and so we walk in and we're like, Mom, this lady outside wants to see you.
Yeah.
And Raina and I are looking at each other. And she tells my mom that she has a acting academy. And if would we be interested in going?
Yeah.
And we were like, oh my God, yes, please. Because at that point, my sister and I used to put on plays for our parents and recite Shel Silverstein poems from Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Yeah.
We were performing.
Yeah, yeah.
So to hear her say that was just like, yes, absolutely.
And it worked out.
It worked out. I didn't have to become a dentist.
A dentist? That was the second choice?
That was the second choice, yes.
Yeah. But that's crazy.
Yeah.
And I saw, like, I mean, you've done so much stuff. I watched the new movie. I did watch that.
Oh, you got a chance to see Caught Stealing?
Yeah, I saw it yesterday.
Oh, sweet.
They set me up at the AMC in Burbank alone at 2 in the afternoon at the whole theater.
Did you? No one else?
No one.
Shut up.
Yeah, it was just me watching it.
I haven't seen it.
You haven't?
I have not seen it.
Really?
Well, because Darren.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm not mad at him for this. He does not want to send out any
screeners.
Links or
well, that's
screeners.
Why they had to do that secret screening.
Yeah.
Oh, you could have come.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. All of the times, because that's what they were doing, what they did with you, which means that's more expensive because they're buying out the theater for that.
Yeah.
Or the showing.
They're not having regular press screenings.
Right. Well, and so... some of the screenings, there are press people there, but they have to work out, you know, when they can come.
Yeah.
And so it just hasn't worked out with my schedule to not watch it on the screener. So I'm going to watch it at the premiere.
It's kind of a great movie in the sense that it's rare that you see a movie where, you know, violence isn't necessarily gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just detached from character, mm-hmm. just something you expect. Because
mm-hmm.
all the violence in it is pretty violent.
Yeah, that's what I keep hearing from people. It's pretty violent.
And but I think the reason people respond to that is because it's all very character driven.
Mm-hmm.
And the frame of the movie is fairly real. He went out of his way because I lived in that area where he shot for years.
Really?
I lived it right on 2nd Street between A and B.
Okay.
So like walking by Benny's Burritos and Kim's Video, I'm like, because I knew he had rebuilt it.
Yeah.
But I literally lived on that block.
Yeah.
For like a couple of years.
Yeah.
And he kind of made it pretty gritty and it seemed like the right time. And there was something, I tell you, once, you know, Liev and Vincent as the Hasidic Jews,
mm-hmm.
it's so hard not to see guys doing those characters and wait for laughs.
Yeah.
But it's the opposite.
Yeah.
But there's that one scene with Carol Kane. I guess you haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet, I know. I can't wait because the feedback has been really great. And honestly, when the script came my way, first, I said, absolutely, I want to read it when I learned it was Darren. Yeah. I mean, there's like every actor, there's, you know, you have your list of directors, filmmakers you want to work with. And I would say everybody, Darren is in their 10.
Oh, yeah?
You know, I feel like it.
Okay.
You know,
you just
respect just his storytelling abilities so much. And so then I read the script and I'm like, okay, so Darren Aronofsky's doing this story. Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Because I'm all about, don't be put in a box.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
And it's very clear that, you know, you may not call this a comedy, but if Darren Aronofsky's going to do a comedy, this is what the comedy is going to be like.
He calls it a comedy?
I don't know that Darren would actually say that it's a comedy, but I know that that is the closest thing to a comedy that Darren would do.
Well, I guess, like, you know,
and he has a sense of humor.
Well, yeah, and there are jokes in there, and it is, you know, it's kind of an underdog story, but it is, the characters are pretty thorough. So, like, you know, even if you have to suspend your disbelief around, you know, some of the, you know, the realities of the thing, and it's clearly shot with this sensibility of, like, it's a guy caught in a caper that he didn't expect to be caught in. So that in itself is sort of a comedic premise.
Right.
And, you know, the punk rock guy is kind of a clown.
Yeah, and Matt Smith. Yeah,
and the Hasids are kind of funny. But your character is very intense. And Griffin Dunn as that
so awesome.
The old guy who owns, he played that really well.
Yeah, Paul.
Yeah.
From Paul's Bar.
Yeah, so there's definitely, I guess if I really think about it, it's comedy. But the weight of where all you guys are coming from is heavy, man, right?
Yeah.
And it is a spoilable movie, so we can't really...
We can't say much.
We can't talk too much, but your character is so great. And just the fact that you're all in, you know, when you see her, you're like, all right, well, this is... Yeah, but we can't... Because the plot twist actually worked.
Yes.
You really don't see them coming.
That's the great thing. And when I read the script...
Yeah.
That's what I told Darren. I said, usually with, you know, with the story, you like, oh, okay. You know, by page 30, you know that this character is going to do this.
Okay? Yeah, yeah, right.
And I was like, Darren, I did not catch it.
Yeah.
So I felt good.
After
I read it the first time, I didn't catch it until, you know, it was revealed.
Yeah.
And there's several of those moments.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I just felt like if anybody's hands this was going to be good in, it's in Darren's hands. And then he's telling me at that point, I want to say only Austin Butler, when there was interest with me, Austin was the only one that was cast.
Yeah.
And so I've heard great things about Austin. And I went and met Darren, and I was, you always like go into something and hold your breath when it's someone you're meeting, someone you're a fan of,
because
you don't want that to be destroyed. I don't want to be like,
you don't want them
fuck
to
Darren
ruin
Aronofsky
it.
Movies.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, I didn't want to feel like that, you know?
Yeah.
And he could not have been more clear about the story that he was trying to tell. And it was the story that I read on that page. I felt like here's an opportunity to do something that is a little pulpy, but it puts us in that place of, even though the film takes place in the 90s, but of those 90s films that we loved.
Yeah.
They weren't a bunch of green screen.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
was like a fight was a real fight.
Yeah.
You know,
A
car crash was a real car crash. You know, just all of that. All of those diehard type feelings that you would have, be suspense at the edge of your seat.
Yeah.
That's how the script read. And so
I think it definitely came off that way.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that you get invested in these characters.
Yeah.
And it's all surprising.
Yeah.
There is a heavy emotional weight that Austin has to carry.
And you know what's also funny to me, Mark, that so often in movies like that, when you have just the character, how did I wind up here?
Yeah.
a lot of times those movies annoy me because, like, we know why you ended up there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You keep doing dumb thing after dumb thing. Whereas with Hank Austin's character, you feel for him because you're like, God, he doesn't deserve that. Yeah, yeah, come on.
Yeah, he had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of great. And the film, If Beale Street Could Talk, I interviewed Jenkins Barry on here.
Wow.
That guy
is
a fucking genius.
I was going to say it, but I let you finish the sentence.
Like, I couldn't, like, you know, I had this experience, you know, watching Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why isn't the entire world talking about
this? I know.
And I just couldn't understand.
But it's back to what we were talking about just 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where things get lost.
Things get lost.
Yeah. But I do think that something like that. And also, you know, there's a certain way that this culture, and I'm no one to call out any specific institutionalized problems, but how they frame, you know, black artists' work, it just doesn't, you know, I don't know how you celebrate something as intelligent and elevated as Underground Railroad unless you have all the critics who are like, this is it.
Right.
You know, this, you know what I mean? Or else it's just no one knows what to do with it or where it goes. Right.
I think, you know, because we are still such a divisive, I'll just say country.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to speak about the rest of the world.
Right.
But, and we are in an even more divisive place than, say, where we were.
Oh, it's horrendous.
You know, before Underground Railroad. I think because we just cannot look at stories as American stories.
Right.
If they're predominantly black people in them or predominantly white people in them, they're predominantly Latino or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
It's their stories, you know, and we're all guilty of it. You know, we've all bought into this construct. And so it's unfortunate because, like you said, someone like Barry Jenkins, who is so brilliant, and it's not really just so much brilliant like smart.
Yeah,
just his taste is brilliant.
Yeah.
When you just look at his filmmaking, like, let's just like take the words out of it.
Yeah,
but the choices that he's making and why he's making those choices is so fascinating. And when you talk to Barry, the thing that I love most, like, I would have to pull myself off the phone every time I talk to Barry because you can't help but lean in.
Yeah.
The way he tells a story, even if it's not a story for television or film, just telling you a story is so engaging and forces you to lean in. And I never felt at any point working with Barry that felt like he was the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
Or made me feel like he never had to over explain something.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, which I find in some conversations, because I'm not quite following what you're saying because, you know, you're talking over me.
Yeah.
I never feel that ever when I'm speaking to Barry.
Yeah, because that movie was beautiful.
It was a really, really loving set in the sense of family was so much the anchor of the story.
Yeah.
And so everyone involved, and you know, it starts with Barry, it starts at the top. So that energy
with the director.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, was within all of us. I mean, we were working and shooting in really small places, like the family apartment.
Yeah,
was an actual a brownstone that we were in. Whereas normally, you're going to have a scene with eight people in the room.
Yeah,
you're going to build that set.
Yeah,
especially when But no, Barry was like, if you could cut the screen and smell it, it would smell like New York.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So you won the big prize.
I won the big prize. Yeah. Yeah, that's what they say.
You've won a lot of prizes.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was doing some press for Caught Stealing last week, and in one of the interviews, they said, so did you know that year you were the most awarded actor, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, we're not just talking about black actors, right? Are we talking about all the actors? And they said, yeah. And I just learned that like last week, you know. That was a real interesting ride for me to be in this business. As long as I had been in this business, I'd never experienced the campaign run.
Oh, right.
So I really had no idea
how it resulted.
How it resulted or what you had to do.
Like,
it's fucking work.
Yeah.
And I was shooting Watchmen. So I was working Monday through Friday. I'd get on a plane Friday night to go promote Saturday and Sunday, screening here, screening there.
Which movie? Beale Street?
To promote Beale Street. Yeah. Like, for the first part of shooting Watchmen, it was.
Yeah, sure. It's a huge thing.
So it was work.
It's work, and sometimes you got to buy them presents.
With the Golden Globe, you know, it's insane. So, but prior to that, I had won Emmys.
Yeah.
Still, that television campaigning, the film, that's just another beast.
Yeah.
That is another beast had my head spinning. And one time I looked up and I had literally, between shooting the show Watchmen and promoting Beale Street, I looked up and I had worked like 21 days straight. And that at that point, your body tells you, I'm out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's done.
I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But 21's pretty good.
Yeah.
I just did like a few weeks for like, I have an HBO special out and I was in a animated movie and, you know, a couple other things. You know, we're ending this show. And after 4 weeks, I was just like, all right, what's going to happen is going to happen.
Yeah, I need that Saturday or at least just Sunday. I need one day to...
Because there's a repetition to it.
Yeah, to recharge, sleep, to not talk.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you don't realize until you don't have that how much you need it.
You burn out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the repetition is what gets you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's very hard to...
And then to be interesting.
That's right. The acting really comes into play when you're getting that same question for the 40th time.
Yeah. And the enthusiasm that people have when they ask that question, like it's the first time it was asked.
I know. It's so...
Is
it's kind of...
Interesting.
Yeah, that's a diplomatic word.
Yeah.
Well, no, you've done amazing work. And I know you've been, you know, very public about your son's passing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've talked a bit about grief on here. Because my partner Lynn died quickly and tragically, and it seems that what I realized for myself before having known what you'd gone through and was different is that there is not really a kind of public conversation that makes grief and the experience of it, no matter what the cause of it, kind of just a human regular thing.
No. And it's interesting because, you know, it's one thing when, you know, it's a parent that's grown old.
Right, sure.
Or something like that.
You're kind of happy. It's like, okay, you've done enough.
You've done, yeah.
You did it.
Yeah. But the hole that is left.
Yeah.
When I speak to other people who've shared the same experience that I have, and I'm speaking to them, and they're like 20 years from it, it never gets refilled, you know? And you just, it softens at times. I've learned the thing that's most clear to me is that expression, mutually exclusive, I don't really exist in that space, you know, like literally sadness and happiness is always working in concert within me all the time. I mean, I can literally
always or just after his death,
after Ian's death.
Yeah.
After Ian, I say peaced out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I can have a guttural laugh.
Yeah.
And literally, it'll end up being a cry.
Yeah.
Or I can have moments where I'm talking to Ian and I'm like, oh, all right, that was a good one.
Yeah.
And then, and feel the joy that he always gives me.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, just miss him so much.
Yeah.
You know? And
How did you deal with the unanswered questions?
I'm always dealing with them. Yeah. You know, sometimes it's just accepting the things that you can't change.
Yeah.
You know, the serenity prayer. But I will say that I have such an amazing support team,
and,
you know, from my mother to my dear friends, and who are all, you know, grieving as well.
Sure.
You know, not the same as me, but I also realize that it's a very unhealthy thing to compare grief.
I used to have Kleenex here. Hold on.
I used to have them right here.
You know what? I have some in my purse.
Oh, you do?
I do. That's another thing that I've learned. I always have that. Yeah, I never had tissue in my purse all the time. And
yeah.
Now I always do.
Yeah, the only reason I brought it up at all is because of it seems that you find it important to have a conversation about it.
I think there's no other way for when you're in the public's and you don't have the blessing of mourning or grieving with your family.
Yeah.
You know, there is that moment of you got 24 hours with the news, you can't stop the police from
jumping the story.
Yeah. And so I tried to stay off of the internet and all of that stuff because you know that someone is going to say something that
terrible.
Is going to, you know, send you. And I had a moment, I don't know how I ended up, something coming across my phone.
And yeah.
Somebody was saying that I guess wants to call themselves a journalist, that they were saying, you know, they were looking at Ian's post and saying that if the family had been paying attention, they would have been able to stop. And that just
killed you.
Just infuriated me.
Yeah.
You know, that. How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you make assumptions about what's happening in our home, in our lives, and how the amount of humility that people don't have is mind blowing.
Yeah, they're predatory cowards.
Yeah.
In terms of information.
So I just started leaning into all of the good energy that was coming towards me and surrounding me, and you know, made the decision that you know my team is like, you're gonna have to say something. You're gonna have to, and I'm like, as Ian used to say with potty training, tomorrow I'll do it. I'll do it soon. And then I knew that I needed to have that first public conversation with someone I trusted. And so that's how Robin Roberts was that person. I reached out to her and said, you know, can I do this with you?
Yeah.
And we had a tearful moment and she was like, absolutely. And, you know, and she took care of me. She made sure that I didn't have to come into the studio.
Yeah.
Like, we went someplace where it's just she and I speaking. Yeah. And the response to people leaning into although it's sad, but that they share something with me, grief.
Right.
You know, we all share a smile.
Yeah.
We all share love.
Yeah.
And I put that in air quotes.
Yeah.
But we all eventually at some point are going to have a relationship with grief.
Yeah.
And, but we don't talk about it, as you said.
People retreat from it.
They retreat from it. So
And also, I think that what happens is what I found in a different situation is that it's not like a hunger, but it brings people together in a way that is so specific. Mm-hmm. And in your situation, people who deal with mental illness, people who deal with the kind of loss you had, people who deal with these unanswered questions about the nature of other people or the nature of their pain or the nature of how to frame that, that any time that a community can come together around something tragic like that, mm-hmm. you know that it's a common story.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we've always, until recently, when a commercial or ad yeah. or something was talking about depression,
yeah.
it would always look like a person that presents very sad.
Right.
And so I am living knowing that that's not what, you know, as I'm, you know, we're going through, you know, Ian's depression.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I'm talking about it. But as we were living it, it was just always so amazing how Ian still would lead with joy.
Yeah.
Even when, you know, we would, and only those close, Ian's father and myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, my sister and close friends of Ian's. And not even all of his friends were aware of yeah. the depression.
Right.
And it's just so irresponsible as human beings in the medical profession to present depression as something that looks like people walking around sad.
Yeah.
Because that's not only how it looks.
Yeah, because it's a battle.
It's a battle, absolutely. Yeah.
And you know, the you know, leading with joy, I mean, you know, that's the fight that yeah. from within.
Yeah.
And then when, you know, when you're sitting by yourself or whatever, you know, it's a constant battle against something that, you know, obviously becomes uncontrollable.
Yeah.
Was there a point where was he trying to do medicine and stuff?
Yes, there was a point, but, you know, there was a period of time of just doing the therapy, doing the,
sure.
going to the psychiatrist yeah. and not wanting to give in to,
medication. Yeah.
And I think probably a lot of it is seeing how so many people were
yeah.
when they were on it, how just kind
sure.
of.
And he's a creative guy.
Creative.
Yeah.
And I do know that if he started the medication sooner, there would not have, all of the music that he wrote, all of the paintings that he would not have
right.
done them.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be a person to sit here and I feel like it's a dangerous place to go to say, if Ian had stayed on medication, that it would have been a different result.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
Yeah.
I don't, this is the result.
Yeah.
I know everything that we did, everything that he did, he had stopped smoking, you know, just everything, working on the depression. And, you know, at one point he said, Mom, I'm just so tired of talking.
Yeah.
And seeing that pain
yeah.
in your child that is working to beat
yeah.
depression, you
yeah.
know, whatever beat depression
yeah.
is,
yeah.
You know, it's really, 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 you know, you feel helpless.
Yeah, yeah.
As a parent.
Yeah.
Because as a parent, you want to be able to provide.
Yeah. Help.
Help.
Yeah.
You're trying to, you know, and what's helpful for you is not helpful for the
sure.
next person, you know.
Sure.
So we're always, when it comes to mental illness
yeah.
especially, you know, it's unfortunately, it is a like trying on clothes.
Sure,
does this fit?
Yeah.
Does this, you know?
Looking for something to work.
Looking for something to work, you know?
Yeah. And like now, do you, is there some sort of path towards acceptance?
Yes, but I still, you know, I just miss him so much.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, like, there are moments that I feel in.
Yeah.
But because I miss him so much, his physical presence.
Yeah.
You know, when that's the person you talk to every day, and or the person that you want to hear there, what would your commentary be on this?
Yeah,
you know,
sure,
Ian, like
sure.
I don't have that,
right.
And I, it's irreplaceable.
Sure,
you know.
Do you still talk to him?
I do.
Yeah,
I do. I do. I do.
It's so hard.
Yeah. So there's no, there's no plan. There's nothing for someone to say, this is what you're supposed to do to accept what fate had in store, you know?
Yeah, I think there are things that say that, but I don't know how good, how, unless you're a deep believer.
Right.
You know?
And, you know, a bit of me, like, I feel like if I didn't have, and maybe this is my own mental shit, that if I didn't have this sadness, then I'd be scared.
Right. Yeah.
Because then that would mean that Ian is not my world.
Right.
You know, then,
sure.
then I was not honest to myself.
Or to him.
Yeah.
Well, you said something somewhere that I thought was kind of amazing, which is that grief is love that doesn't have anywhere to go.
Yes. I can't remember who actually said that, but my aunt, and I say my aunt, my play aunt, I've known her, my mother and her have been friends ever since they were in the fourth grade.
Yeah.
She had given her a card that said that.
Yeah.
And my mom gave it to me.
Yeah.
And that it just really stuck with me because gave me words to verbally express how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think that with your work and with, you know, honoring his memory by, you know, sharing it, it's just, I think that it can't be.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Talked about enough that, you know, this is a disease, you know?
Exactly.
And that it's not something you can will yourself out of.
Honestly, Mark, I think that's the biggest stigma is that people can't look at mental health as a disease.
Yeah.
Like you can if someone has, let's just say, cancer.
Yeah.
And they whatever drugs or whatever put them into remission.
Yeah.
There's, and then you have someone else that has cancer and they do all the drugs and they don't go into. So what's the difference? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Of someone that's using all of the therapy tools.
Yeah.
With all of the.
All the different ways.
All the different therapies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I know that Ian is tired.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I know that there is a part of him that looked at people much older than him still fighting that battle and losing it.
Yeah.
That had an, I'm sure, made an impression on him.
Yeah. And I just feel like, you know, when it's just, you know, talking about it, there, like that, I think if anything, that whether it seems impossible to have a sort of deep acceptance of tragedy, you know, in your own life. But I do think that making it, you know, demystifying it and accepting the illness.
Yeah.
And that, you know, this is an illness that happens to a lot of people. And like you said, some people, you know, can get through it, kind of. Some people don't. That's the only thing you can do.
And honestly, Mark, for one, thank you for, you know, making this space safe, you know, for me to talk, and that this was not what we were having this interview for. But I think a big part of me, just because it's Ian, it's my heart.
Yeah.
We're in this cancel culture, and that I have been so thoughtful to be very selective with when I speak, who I'm speaking to, because people are just waiting to cancel somebody or to take what someone says and pick it apart and say what a person really meant.
Right.
You know, I mean, you even see, they even look at people's body language and say, this is what this person means.
Sure,
when this couple holds each other, like, so, you know, I'm like, don't fuck with Ian.
Yeah.
So that's part of me, the reason why I'm very selective when I'm speaking.
Sure.
Yeah.
And also, just stay away from that shit.
Yeah. That part. Yeah. That part.
Because it's just, there's, it's part of that sort of mania that we talked about at the beginning.
Yeah.
There's just this frenzy.
Yeah.
To create garbage at the cost of people's feelings, their hearts, their lives.
Right.
Just, and people, nobody's do it. Yeah. Who are these fucking people?
Yeah. Keyboard gangsters.
Yeah. You got, I try to stay as far away from that as possible.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I had, you know, after Lynn died, there were monsters, you know, saying, you know, like, Mark killed his girlfriend. You know, like, it's like, who sits there and does that? You know, like, diminish it. It's inhuman.
It's inhuman.
But you can't expect humanity from this monster that we carry around with us.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry if I got you too down.
No. Well, that's the thing. Like what I said before, like, it's happiness and sadness are always working in, and I really mean it when I say in concert. Because if I don't embrace it as in concert,
you know what's weird? I just realized about that is that it does that happiness and sadness in concert, because once you have a foundation of grief, that on some level, you understand the battle of, you know, of non-clinical sadness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I guess that is the human spirit, is to keep, you know, that balance.
Yeah.
Because what else are you going to do? Everyone's going to go through this.
What else are you going to do?
Yeah.
That's when one of my, I was like, Mom, I just sometimes, I just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
She said, you do what you're doing. You're here.
I get that so much. And because, like, I don't think I really look to my parents for advice much after a certain point, because they weren't those kind of parents. And there's some days, and I'm 61, there's some days there's like, would someone please just tell me what to do?
Do. just tell me what to do. Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to sit with.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we could talk about the wine.
We could.
Would that be a good transition for you to go out on?
I mean,
or are you good?
Absolutely. I mean, it's Ian's name is right there in the middle. Shit.
How'd you get involved with wine?
Ian.
Really?
I mean,
he was a wine guy?
Ian is a loves a story and loves and has great taste.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So when you're an artist like he is, and you discover new things, you want to be the one to share it.
Yeah.
You would, and so he would share wines with me, you know? Like, he just, and I think a lot of it came from being a chef.
Yeah.
You know, he just, the pairing of
food. He was a chef?
Yeah. Of all,
sure.
Of so many things.
Yeah.
He was a chef. A musician. I mean, he was even in One Night in Miami, an audition for the role. But I digress. So with the wine, Ian introduced me to orange wine about 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I've never had any desire to be in this industry, in the hospitality.
Yeah.
Well, no, let me take that back, because I did have a restaurant, but never to actually sell
a brand,
yeah, you know, of wine.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone that you speak to that's in the business is always like, if you want to lose money, that's the business you get into. And so in this space of trying to understand what this new relationship is with Ian, you know, I was always looking for ways to, when you're talking to your friends and they're talking about what their children are doing now, and I have old stories.
Yeah.
How do I create new stories?
Yeah.
And
good. Yeah.
So it was like, we're going to do an orange wine.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how the birth of Me and You.
Is that what it's called?
Yes. It's spelled M-I-A-N-U. Uh-huh. And you pronounce it Me and You.
Yeah.
And Ian's name is in the middle, because when you put the M and the U on the end.
Yeah.
So,
and is it like small batches, or how does it
small
work?
This is self-financed.
Okay.
I'm the vineyard, or I'm procuring the grapes. So, small. I have people like, oh my God, you going to send me some? I'm like, absolutely not. I am not. But it is available at meandyouwines.com.
There you go. Yeah. There's no samples.
Yeah.
No samples for the press.
Well, no, some samples for the press.
Oh, good,
But very smart samples.
And how's it landing?
It's landing very. We're almost sold out.
Oh,
so
good.
That's pretty exciting.
And then you do another batch?
Yes, and now I'm in the business part of it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it was more just a way to put something in a bottle that was as the closest. For people who did not get the opportunity to be blessed with Ian's presence, to taste something and get an idea of just how whimsical he can be, how tasty he can be, how artistic he can be. The label is very artisanal. It's like a canvas.
Oh, nice.
And so I'm just doing that more, just this is Ian and I creating this together.
I love it,
And then now I have to think about the business part of it.
Are we going
to
make it bigger?
How do we sustain? How do we, am I going
wine?
To look at a different, looking at a wine with different grapes?
Is that fun?
Most part it is.
Yeah.
For the most part it is. But it's a little terrifying, because I had to enter back into the social media space.
Oh.
And so I kind of slowly started doing it, knowing that the wine launch was coming up. And that's...
you can also have someone do that for you. Filter it.
I'm a control enthusiast.
Okay. Well, that's... I've never heard it put that way.
Yeah.
I like that. That almost sounds like something you could put on a business card.
Regina King, control enthusiast, at your service.
Yeah.
All
right. Well, it's a beautiful thing that you're doing, and it's great talking to you.
It's been great talking to you, too. Well, what are you going to do next? I understand that I'm lucky enough to get in here. Yeah.
Well, I got to do another season of that show with Owen Wilson.
Mm.
And, I just put out a special, and I'm, starting to build another bunch of comedy of some kind. I want to try and take it somewhere different.
Yeah.
I feel like I've said all I've got to say on some level, and I want to try to say something different.
I was about to say something different.
Yeah.
You don't feel like you've said everything you have to say.
Yeah.
You just want to say something different.
Yeah, some part of me thinks I can lighten up a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like, and maybe again, it's just me.
Yeah.
To me, when the humor is rooted in, like, the real shit,
it's better.
It's funnier.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a whole, my last special was From Bleak to Dark, but there was about a half hour about grief.
Yeah, wow. I have to check that out.
You should. It's an HBO special, and it was about, finding some way of coping and dealing with what happened and making it a public thing to release some of that, because the sadness is real, is unavoidable, but there, even inappropriate jokes around it that you can have with yourself, that, you know, that other people who've been through it can share in, but people who haven't are like, oh shit.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But those are important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, highly.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Thanks
too.
For doing it. Okay. I know it was real. That was real stuff there. You can go see Caught Stealing tomorrow. It opens everywhere. And check out her new wines at meandyou.com. That's MIANU.com. Hang out for a minute, folks.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Hey, people, on Monday's show, a return guest, Tim Heidecker. He was on an early episode by himself, then once again with Eric Wareheim. Now we're having one last talk in the garage.
I did cry once on stage during the music.
It's so vulnerable to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just feel like, I think that doing the music and sort of moving through that fear, it's going to help my stand-up in a way, because I'm just tired of the patter.
Yeah. There is something about, like, wondering what – I'm so clear about why I'm doing it for myself.
Yeah.
But I don't know how close I am to understanding if I'm doing it for the right reasons for my audience.
Yeah.
That's the trick.
But how much of that lives in our head anyways? And, you know, like – And in the comments, like, I don't know. Like, I'd worry about that, too. Like, oh, let's indulge Mark
right.
with his little music dream.
Yeah.
And certainly growing up, seeing comics that do music, I'm like, oh, fuck. What's he doing? You know,
yeah.
It didn't go well for Kennison.
Right.
You know, when he was pretty serious about it. Any comic that is music seriously.
I know.
It's very hard to watch, to frame it correctly.
Yeah.
Even if they're amazing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And it's a shame because I think we all come from, like, growing up wanting to just do stuff.
Yeah.
And not thinking about the genre and how it's going to be classified at Blockbuster Video or whatever.
I guess. But, like, when Eddie Murphy did My Girl Wants to Party all the time.
Oh, terrible. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll agree with that.
Yeah.
But it's it all comes down to, if you're not doing it to sell records.
Yeah.
And you're doing it earnestly to, you know, express yourself.
Yeah.
Then it's legit.
I think that's where I'm coming from. I have things about I want to say that don't belong in my comedy.
Yeah, I haven't figured out how to write a song yet.
Yeah.
I think I've probably written some, but I have to, like, find them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, either John Lennon says, like, keep it short and make it rhyme.
Did he?
Yeah, I think so.
But he also has all those chords. You have the Beatles
chords.
Yeah, I don't. I'm still strictly a 1-4-5.
No, those are good too.
With an
those
occasional.
Those are the catchy ones.
With an occasional two.
Two minor.
Yeah, two minor. Right, yeah. Exactly. To make it pop.
Yeah.
That's Monday, which is also the 16th anniversary of our very first episode. Wow. Wow. How did that happen? Also, a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast, and here's a little jigsaw puzzle. lives. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.